Hi, this is Tom, and you're listening to STEM Punk, a podcast about STEM and other things. This week's episode is an interview that Shane did with the projection designer at the Melbourne Planetarium, Warwick Lawrence. I hope you enjoy it, but before we get into that, I'm going to share with you some pretty cool news that we've had. We have set up and we're going to be running a live STEM Punk quiz event. This event is going to be held at the Wayward Breweries in Annandale, Sydney, and it's going to be run sort of like a Rockwiz / Spicks and Specks, but with more science type thing. They'll be hosted by the STEM Punks, which is Christy, Shane, and myself, and we'll have team captains, will be one of us, as well as some really exciting guests, some scientific guests, and we're going to ask a few rounds of different questions based on science, technology, engineering, maths, with some live demonstrations, some audience participation, and of course, prizes. Please go to our website, stempunkpodcast.blogspot.com, or our Facebook page or Twitter account at stempunk3 to find out all the details. Very exciting news. I hope to see you at Wayward Breweries in Annandale on June 21 for our first ever live show. June 21, Wayward Breweries. It's going to be fun.
We're here at the Melbourne Planetarium Science Work with Warwick Lawrence, whom I believe is the production designer here. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. That's my title.
Can you, well, first thing, tell me more about yourself and what you do here.
All right. Okay, well, my title is production designer for the Melbourne Planetarium. We are the only planetarium in the Southern Hemisphere that actually produce planetarium shows on a continuing basis. So the Melbourne Planetarium's been at Science Works, which opened in 1999, and in that time we've produced 17 shows, I believe. I've been here since 2005 working on the planetarium shows. We produce shows primarily for our own audience, so we have shows to present to our audience here. But we've also, since probably 2005, found that we can now start to actually on-sell our shows. So we're selling our shows internationally as well. I came in 2005 as an animator. My actual background is in the film industry. So I used to work as a camera assistant for about 10 years in the Melbourne film industry, and then got involved in computers and animation and was making projects for the museum while I was working at RMIT University. And then an opportunity came up here to work on one of our first fully rendered shows, which was called The Problem with Pluto. And I came in as an animator on that, and I've been here ever since.
And you loved it, I take it?
Yeah, look, the opportunity to make content for this environment is fantastic. So, you know, the immersive nature of the full dome environment where you're immersing the audience in a film is just absolutely wonderful. And it's an interesting one because you try and describe it for radio or podcast and it really is impossible. But the way I quite often have talked about the experience, because in our planetarium, in our particular planetarium, it's one where you lie back. So the seats recline right back and you're lying back looking up. And when the screen goes, when it goes dark, you really quickly lose sense of where that screen is. Whereas in the cinema, you always have an idea that the screen's down there in front of you. In a planetarium, that completely disappears, particularly when you have a very, very dark night sky projected up there. And it becomes a much more visceral experience because you've completely lost that sense of where you are, and so you are so much more immersed into it. And you can't find sort of something that's more fun to work in making, you know, content and animation for that sort of environment is really fantastic opportunity. And so, you know, I did one and, you know, I was pretty much hooked straight away. So it's really...
And you've been working here ever since?
That's correct, yes.
So that was an interesting transition to, I guess, from flat screen to a curved projection in a sense.
Well, yeah, in a way, I mean, as I said, in prior to getting into computers and animation, I work on in film production. And then when I originally got involved with doing computers and animation, I actually did an advanced diploma of multimedia, studying computer animation, and I ended up making content for the what was called at the time iCubed, which was a center for innovation center at RMIT University, and they had a virtual reality lab as part of that, or a virtual reality center was also a part of that center, and I was originally developing content then for an installation at the Melbourne Museum, which was called the Virtual Room. And the Virtual Room was made up of 8 large screens, they're about 2.5 meters by 1.5 meters, and they were formed into the shape of an octagon. We used stereoscopic projection, and you walked around the outside of this room wearing your stereoscopic 3D glasses, and it was to create the illusion that whatever was being projected onto those walls was actually inside that octagon. So I was already interested in the idea of using virtual reality and immersive spaces. And I think as part of that, when I actually first applied for work at the planetarium, I was able to sort of like refer to the fact that I'd already been making content for the virtual room, which was already a part of the Melbourne Museum. So it sort of seemed to be a nice natural kind of fit for working in that sort of space.
It's pretty cool. Most of our guests that we have on the show more have a science background, and you have more of, I guess, a technology background for STEM. So what I'm trying to get at is what is your impression of STEM, or what do you think STEM is? Good question.
It's a very good question, and I'm thinking, I could really shoot myself in the foot. STEM's a very interesting one, because from the museum's perspective, and particularly from ScienceWorks' perspective, as we are a science museum, there is a huge amount of interest in terms of the way this is reaching into schools. Particularly, obviously, it's got a lot of government backing behind it, and it's just such an incredibly important area that people are moving into, and to encourage students to move into. And we are a perfect resource, like a science museum is the perfect resource for STEM education. I think the planetarium within itself is also, the perfect environment almost in terms of teaching large elements of STEM education. So we're perfectly geared towards that. And, it really is going to be crucial in terms of, just inspiring and engaging those students who are really, get more kids into STEM areas, because as we know, that's just going to be a huge, that's the huge future in regards to an enormous amount of job creation is going to be in those areas, and yet we sort of still don't have enough students in many of those areas.
Yeah, so you feel as though your position, you can actually help influence that, just be making students of the next generation be aware that STEM is actually important to day-to-day lives?
Well, certainly we're always at the planetarium interested in inspiring. One of the things, and I think we were discussing this earlier, is that there used to be the old model of, your students used to be treated as vessels that you had to fill with knowledge.
Yes.
And eventually it was realised that that's not really a very efficient model. And we know that when students come out of a planetarium show, we certainly don't expect them to be, knowing specific numbers, or, if you saw our show on the seasons, they're not going to necessarily remember that the angle of Earth is 23.5 degrees, but we're going to be inspiring them, and they're going to go and want to know more about this information, or go out and find out more for themselves. And when you combine that sort of education, that sort of inspirational education, in with all the other programs that you'll have in your schools, you can really engage men and show students.
That's very good. Now, with an early episode, we actually talked about whether we should change STEM to STEAM. In other words, add the letter A with arts.
Well, and of course.
So how, from your perspective, how would you combine STEM with STEAM then? Like combining arts with film or with planetarium,
look,
I guess.
I mean, a lot of people, and it was really interesting hearing Brian Schmidt talk recently, and he was talking about, and some of the best people, they talk about science is storytelling. It was very interesting, the, you know, without telling that story and that sort of engagement of people, you, it becomes, it doesn't have any meaning for people. And for me, art is you know, that is the way that you can really engage people on so many different levels. And there are, you know, so many groups now who are looking at, you know, how we can combine that art and science together in many ways. I, you know, think of, you know, there's, you know, different groups within Australia, like the Australian Network for Art and Technology, who, you know, who basically embody this idea of bringing artists and scientists together to, you know, to engage with the general public.
You've been working on your latest production. Well, it's actually been launched now, Capturing the Cosmos. Do you think that's also capturing STEM in some way?
It certainly fits. It certainly fits within to the, you know, that area, the whole STEM area.
Yeah.
I mean, for us, it's our first co-production, or our first show that we've done in partnership with a scientific group. So it's been Capturing the Cosmos has been produced in partnership with the ARC Centre for Excellence in for All Sky Astrophysics.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful, Castro. It's an unusual name, but hey, it works.
Yeah. And that is just a really fabulous opportunity to be working with them, not only for the level of science they bring into it, the quality of the science they bring into it, but the ability for it to outreach to the public and being promoting and showing the science that actually is happening within Australia. Now, you know, how can you get kids more interested in the astronomy research that's being done in Australia? Well, you show them what is being done, and you show that in a very engaging way. And so I think, you know, Capturing the Cosmos will be an excellent tool for promoting STEM. The main focus of it is we are looking at the way new astronomy is using this new approach of what is being called all sky astrophysics. So if you can imagine, since for the last 400 years, since the advent of the telescope, we've been looking at objects, whether it be, you know, planets or galaxies or nebula, and as time has progressed, we've refined the ability of those telescopes to look further and further and further into space. But every time we're looking at those objects, we're looking at smaller and smaller and smaller pieces of the actual sky. So there's been a new approach that they're looking at, a way of looking at astronomy and astrophysics, is to try and capture what's happening in the sky kind of all the time, all at once. So some of the questions that they're hoping to answer can only be done by looking at this, the universe, on a much, much grander scale. And within the show, we do focus on two particular telescopes. We're focusing on the Murchison Wide Field Array, or the MWA telescope, which is out in Western Australia, and that's a radio telescope. And so that's looking into very much the past and the history of the universe, and looking at the way it explores what's called the epoch of reionization. So exploring very much what's happened exactly, you know, in the first few hundred, you know, first short period of time after the Big Bang. The other telescope they're also focusing on in this particular show is called the SkyMapper telescope, and that's based up in Coonabarra Brand. And that telescope, for one example, happens within the show, is it's looking at the number of supernova that are actually happening up in the night sky, and they are happening at a much
more rapid rate than you would expect. They're going off all the time, but we don't see them because while one will be happening up there, if your telescope's not trained to look on it, you're not going to see that. So this telescope can actually capture large sections of the night sky in one go, and it can do that over and over and over during the night and build up a record of actually what's happening. And by comparing images from whether they're days or weeks or months apart, they can suddenly spot where things have actually changed, and they can pick up where supernovas have happened. And those supernovas can be very important because that's one of the ways that we can help measure how quickly the universe is expanding. So that will help us understand the future of the universe in that sense. So it's interesting to sort of see how one telescope is very much looking into the past, one telescope is very much being used to look into the future, and also discovering so many more other discoveries, because as science, I think, has always found, is that the more you learn, the more questions you suddenly have.
Yes. So that's pretty cool. So you effectively come from a non-scientific background.
Yes.
And yet you've probably picked up a lot of information along the way, especially when you're discussing about cosmology concepts. It's like, this is not what a normal person really talks about. So guess what I'm saying? Do you find it insightful that you've actually learned so much about science in your time here?
Yes, I have. And what I think is also very interesting is because I think I work very closely with our astronomer, Dr. Tanya Hill, and we work off each other very well, in the sense that if I don't understand the science, I'll just keep saying I don't understand the science, or I don't find that part of this story, I'm not engaged with this. Why should I be interested in this part of the story? And until Tanya, I'll make Tanya go back and go, what's really going to be engaging about that? And I think it's very important to have sort of someone on in the production side who doesn't actually come from the science background, because you need that sort of always need that lay perspective of kind of going, well, why is it interesting? Why is it important? I mean, I should take Tanya, you can usually tell me why it's important, but I want to know, why is it interesting?
Yes. So it's an interesting relationship you have, to you two having, like Tanya's sort of, I guess, an expert in the field, and you're coming from a storytelling point of view.
Yeah.
And I guess that's how you approach all your production, is how well I can tell the story.
Yeah, I'm very interested in what's the narrative, and and whenever we've done any production, we're always sort of starting with, well, what's the human part of this? Where can we make the connection? Where can we make it relevant to people's own lives? Can be, it's an essential part, because you can put as much information and as much science into the show, but unless you engage your audience, it's pointless.
It's going to go over their heads, or too much information. As you said before, it's like, it's not filling the young person's mind with a lot of knowledge. It's whether you can inspire them or engage them during the production.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very good balance to have, I think. So.
Yeah. And working in this full-time production environment, making shows for planetariums, it's very interesting to see how that is now expanding beyond astronomy, because we now, if you look at the history of planetariums, it used to be based on star projectors, which would only project stars onto your planetarium dome, whereas now we're using video projection systems, which means you can put anything there. So we're not just using planetariums for astronomy, but we can actually use them for exploring a whole range of Earth sciences. So there's been a lot of shows that have been done about the oceans underwater, been shows produced about the environment, a whole variety of different STEM subjects can now actually be engaged in the planetarium, but also art as well. And so there has been a wide range of art shows being produced for the planetarium, and artists using it. And I'm very interested in exactly what we can do in terms of the narrative in this environment. And the future of this is really exciting. And so I'm engaging with more and more different artists who are really starting to explore.
Can you comment more about exploring the future with planetarium? It's like, is there anything on the horizon that you can sort of see that's coming? that were influenced?
Look, in my mind, I still feel like in some ways I'm waiting for someone like the person, maybe it's James Cameron to discover the planetarium. Or maybe it's when the recent film that came out, Gravity, with Sandra Bullock came out, and I saw that at IMAX, and I was just going, why didn't they make it for Full Dome? It would have just been the perfect film to see in the Full Dome environment, because it was just such an immersive sort of and personal sort of story, and a personal experience would have been so brilliantly adapted for this environment. And I imagine if someone like James Cameron came along and decided that they were going to put the sort of money and value, production values into a Full Dome and made a very expensive Full Dome production, you could do quite a lot with it. And certainly his interest in both out of space, but also in deep sea oceanography would be a perfect fit for someone like him.
So you mentioned there's a bit of a cost involved. So can you talk about how much resources will get pumped into a, just say for one Full Dome presentation that you guys produce here?
Look, at Full Dome productions have a wide range of costs, and I have seen people producing shows on a shoestring. You do have some of the big American museums who have the capacity to maybe put in as much as $3 to $5 million on a production. We certainly don't have that sort of budget here in Melbourne. Our budgets would really sit at $200,000 or so. It can depend, it can be more, it can be less than that, depending on the show and on the circumstances of the actual production of the show. So that gives you sort of the range of what show productions can be. But that's got to be in context with where planetariums are currently. And at the moment where most planetariums are attached to museums or universities, so they still fit very much into educational facilities for the majority of that. So there are some that are being set up as separately, which some are being done much more as entertainment centres in some respects. So there are some places now that are opening up which have a more emphasis on entertainment rather than education. But then if you're looking at the whole thing in regards to a business model,
you've got to have a bit of cost recovery or make a bit of profit.
It's got to be a viable business. And at this stage, it's not really likelihood. There's not a likelihood of people going into suddenly making. There's a reason. There's only one company. There's only so few Full Dome production places around the world. It's very time consuming. It's very expensive, and there's no guarantee of getting a return on your investment, I guess, in those senses.
Yes. And that's probably one of the reasons why Melbourne Planetarium is the only one producing shows in Australia.
Yeah, I think we're very lucky. It grew out of the fact that we are, I believe, the oldest planetarium in Australia, and the original planetarium was at the old museum when it was in Swanston Street in Carlton, Swanston Street in the city. In the original, its original site, there was a small optomechanical star projector there. And when you have optomechanical star projectors, generally you have to create your own shows from scratch, whether that's a narrative or any sort of story, or it'll have a particular focus. So you are still producing stories in that sort of sense. So there's always been that tradition of having to make shows for an audience, but it's been more since we converted to a video production, or in terms of the video Full Dome system, that we have really started to develop shows where we could produce them and then on sell them to other planetariums.
Ah, yes. Yeah. you produced a number of shows over the number of years you've been here at Melbourne Planetarium. Is there a personal favourite that you've worked on?
I don't like to give out favourites, but I think it really was when we did our show Tilt, which is about the seasons, and it's a show pitched for upper primary school kids in terms of explaining the seasons. And one of the things for me, particularly which I really liked with that show, was that for quite a few shows that we had made before that, there was always been a paradigm where you have a main character who's off screen. And it's been done not only by our productions, but like other productions around the world, because that's, you know, in the early days of production, it was very difficult to put characters on screen. And we'd done quite a number of shows in that vein. And I had always wanted to make something which had a narrative structure where we actually decided we would put the characters on the screen. And when we first started pitching this to our management, yeah, they were a little bit concerned that we wanted to do, you know, put the characters on the screen. There's also, you know, I think it was sold to them a little bit on the sense that, you know, we could keep it quite simple, and in effect, there is quite a degree of simplicity in it. So I think that we managed to get away with it because the plan was would be kept quite simple. But I think in their minds it was going to be sort of something that was going to be a 2D style animation of flat 2D graphics of characters animated on the dome. And that certainly was not the intention that I had with doing it. So we really brought these characters to life, and we did 3D character animation. So it was the first time we'd done 3D character animation, we'd done 3D character animation with lip sync animation on the screen. So it was really taking the whole production up a level. We brought in character animators to work on that. We had the script was developed by, outsourced by people who'd done writing for children's TV. And we did bring the script in, and it was interesting because the original proposition behind it was there were within the show there is the boy and a girl, brother and sister, are the two main characters, and the initial relationship between them was kind of be the younger annoying brother with the older sister who's always really and the character who's always annoyed with her younger brother, and the character's always going to be fighting. And we would sort of like were not completely satisfied with where the script was at that stage, and we brought in a comedian at the time. He just to look through it and throw some ideas, and he said, "Well, yeah, this relationship—it's always like this. Why do you have to have the relationship like this? Can they actually like each other? And maybe they joke with each other and tease each other and play with each other." And that just that one sort of idea changed the balance of the characters. And that was enormously important in terms of trying to get this really nice dynamic relationship between the characters on the screen. And then, I haven't even told you really any of the narrative of Tilt.
Well, you're going to have to see the show.
Well, you'd have to see. No, but I think I'm happy to divulge some of it. Yeah. The basic premise is Annie, the older sister, is working on a project on Seasons of the World for school, and she's making a model of the solar system when her brother rushes into the room and all these prodding and poking and interrogation manages to break the model. And when he breaks the model, it suddenly sends the seasons out of whack and it starts snowing in the room. Well, the only way they can resolve this is obviously go into space and see what's going on.
Obviously.
So through the use of his toy rocket and a toy robot, they go on a journey through the solar system and visiting all the different parts on Earth to see how the season is different in different parts of the world. So it's quite an adventure that they go on. There's quite a bit of drama within the storyline, particularly, you know, where they could be trapped and things like that. And there's also quite a lot of humour with this, you know, robot telling very bad jokes along the way. But also, what's really nice within that is it's not just one character explaining things. It's between the characters. It's like the robot does tell them some things, but they also make a lot of questions and bounce ideas off each other to work out how this works. And I think it's a really good way. And what I do like is when you sit in the audience with that, and you know, adults come out of that show with a better understanding of the seasons. And as I was discussing with you earlier today, you know, the title of the show is just called Tilt, and there was at one stage a discussion of people wanting to call it Tilt, the reasons for the seasons, which I really did not like. And wanting to keep it a much simpler title, just cutting it down and calling it one word, which was Tilt. And still, for me, if people come out of that show, and kids come out of that show, and they can, you know, they went and saw a show called Tilt. Well, what was it about? Oh, it was about the seasons. Well, how did the seasons work? Well, they instantly know. They can remember Tilt. They're kind of, you know, a fair part of the way to remembering what's going on in terms of how the actual seasons work. And it's a great show. It's really good music composed for it as well. So it's a lot of fun as well. Yeah. And we've also done like a lot of other documentary shows as well. So it's one of the ones that has much more narrative structures. Certainly the ones that I've worked on.
So when you say documentaries, is it more for the audience? Is more for an adult,
Well, when we've done our kids shows always have a very strong narrative element. So our show on the moon, which is called Tycho to the Moon, which is about a dog who goes to the moon. Again, it's got a very much a narrative structure, and that show focuses on the phases of the moon and sort of, and that's pitched more at an age range of about 3 to 8 years old. But when we've produced the other more recent shows, such as Our Living Climate, Black Hole, Starlight, they are much more a documentary style. That's not to say that those shows will not necessarily have narrative elements to them. In fact, Starlight, which is our most recent production before Capturing the Cosmos, has a very strong narrative element to it. And it's told from the perspective of a woman and who originally, as a young child, is afraid of the dark and learns to appreciate the stars and is told that, well, why be afraid of the dark if the night is filled with stars? And that initiates her journey and her discovery and her fascination with the stars, which continues on through her life. And we actually visit that same character through different parts of her life. So by the end of the show, when she's a grandmother talking to her grandchildren, explaining some of the stories that occur in the stars through constellations, it's that nice sort of sense that the same stars you look at as a child are the same stars you look at as throughout your entire life. In fact, they're the same stars that people looked at, you know, 40,000 years ago. And so that's kind of got such a nice, beautiful, evocative element. I mean, Starlight itself was, Starlight's my favourite. You know, Tilt's my favourite. Starlight's my favourite. It's got some really beautiful, evocative moments throughout that show as well.
So, wow, that's great insight there. it's also, I think, having through this discussion, I believe it's more important to have people like yourself working alongside scientists such as Tanya to actually try and tell the story of promotion of science or even technology, engineering or mathematics out there. And narrative is obviously very important. Is there any final thoughts you'd like to say about the process of storytelling or anything like that, or from your perspective?
No, but when you go back to STEM, I keep thinking, yeah, we don't have any engineering shows in the planetarium.
Oh, right.
I've seen one really good mathematics show. So it's really interesting that there's these other areas which I think would be perfectly for exploring in that. And earlier today we were talking about particle physics and how it'd be great to have a show about particle physics, but there's so many areas of science and all of STEM that are yet to be fully explored.
Because there tend to be a bias towards astronomy in that sense.
Well,
that was the history.
That's the history. The history of the planetarium was, you know, was developed in the, you know, late 20s, early 30s, was when they developed the optical mechanical projector, star projector, and so most planetariums were associated with science museums or science centres or observatories even, and it's really only since the late 90s when video projection capabilities came into the full dome that people have really started to explore that, and that has got so much more where it can go. But even here at ScienceWorks, and we are a science museum, every show that we have produced is still astronomy based, and we will, for the current time, we will continue producing astronomy focused shows. That, you know, obviously there is potential for that to change at some stage in the future, but it is happening around the world where people are producing a much wider variety of content for this, you know, amazing immersive medium.
So watch this space. Well, thank you very much, Warwick Lawrence. It's an absolute pleasure having you on the show, and we'll no doubt see you next production in the coming years.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Cheers.